Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the last full weekend of January 2026. We have come to the end here of a nice stretch of, I think it's probably 10 days or so, of sunny weather. And given the time of year, it was pleasantly warm out, at least not frigid. We didn't have an outflow event. I think instead it was a high pressure ridge that built up from further south. So really calm conditions, of course, frosty overnight, but temperatures typically above freezing during the day. Hope you had a chance to get out and enjoy some of that weather. I know I was able to get out a little bit and also was able to get out and see the sunsets. I appreciated having those clear skies and the opportunity to go chase a green flash. I got a little bit of one just over the cloud bank that was far out there on the horizon. But this is the time of year for that. And as a result of chasing the sunsets, I am noticing now our sunset here in Sitka is after 4 p.m. So I've already gained 45 minutes basically since the earliest sunset back in December. So if you like longer days, well, they're coming our way. If you're getting out, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can get on my website, sitkanature.org, check out archives of the show, or leave me a comment there. This week, I have in the studio as I'm recording this, I have my son, Connor. He's been a guest, about once a year, the last few years. And I think last time we talked about birds, we'll have some birds to talk about today. And maybe some boating adventures. We had a chance to get out and explore a little bit at times over the past year on those rare days you weren't working. It seemed like you had plenty of work going on. And then also diving. I think you just started getting into diving. Maybe you just finished up the dive class when we talked last year around this time. So maybe we could just start with last Saturday. We went out, and I guess that was an adventure for you. I went out with you and Paul, and we went, well, first of all, it was a lot rougher than we expected, just waves coming in, which doesn't really mean that much for y'all in the water. But for me going to shore, which was the plan, I was not interested in wrangling a little dinghy and big surge. The tide was high, so all the little barrier islands were much smaller, not knocking the waves down as much. We ended up over by the Cassiana Islands, and I went ashore there, and you and Paul got in the water there. Do you want to talk a little bit about your experience with that dive?
Yeah, and that was the first dive that I'd had for a couple months, because Paul had gone on vacation and just hadn't gotten in the water much before then. And so we got in the water there. There was a bit of a stiff current, which I wasn't all that bothered by at the time. And we got down to the bottom and saw some interesting, saw a new prickleback down there at the bottom, which is a little fish. Bottom was made up of like silt and shells, so it was interesting to look around on that type of bottom. We ended up surfacing further away from the boat than we had originally planned, which resulted in a much longer surface swim than we had planned to do, and in the high current was challenging for me to do.
Well, I might interject here just briefly. I was on shore. I was feeling kind of tired, so I'd found a spot in the sun and taken a nap, and then dozed off, I'm sure, for a little bit, and then wandered down to a rocky shoreline that was in the sun and looked over, and I just goes, oh, there's a couple otters over there. That's interesting. Those weren't, and it's like, wait, those are really awkward-looking otters, and then it's like, oh, that's Paul and Connor. What are they doing way over there? You're on the other side of the island I was on from where the boat was. And yeah, and then it was interesting though how much like you sort of look like otters, I guess, because you have the tanks on, so you're probably mostly on your back because you don't want, it's hard to have those out of the water, I suppose. And then so it's just your head and your feet up, so you kind of have that otter look, especially from a distance. But it didn't take long to realize that you were not as smooth and graceful in the water as the sea otters tend to be.
Yeah, it definitely is. Something that I need to work on more, but I got stuck in the current for a little while before I decided to swim closer to shore where there was perhaps less current and actually was able to make some ground. But it was tiring. I was exhausted by the end of that swim to get out.
Yeah, I think Paul told me that y'all went down into a little bit of a basin, and he ended up a little turned around and didn't really think about the fact that it was a bowl and there were islands in every direction. So he just kind of thought he was facing a certain direction and thought, oh, well, if I go up, we'll end up back on the island that we were anchored by. But it turned out you ended up over by the island, the next island over, basically. And I don't know how far the swim was, but y'all weren't making progress very fast to begin with. I was like, wow, you guys are kind of going slow. And then Paul ended up coming over by me and said hello and then kind of cruised around and you lagged behind a little bit.
Yeah, I think Paul figured out to swim to the side of the current faster than I did, so he did it earlier and got out of the bulk of the current sooner than I did, and which resulted in him getting back to the boat and me being extremely tired.
Well, lessons learned, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, so next time it's find your way out of the current and don't go the wrong way if at all possible.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... Most of the places I've dove haven't had that type of current, so it hasn't been an issue in the past, and we've ended up closer to the boat. So,
do you notice it much when you're underwater, or you just kind of move? I guess if you're close to the bottom, maybe, and it's pulling you along.
It kind of depends on where the ground structure. Like when he and I dove No Thoroughfare, you noticed it, even though we dove pretty close to a slack tide, you noticed it a bit in there because just of how much current was getting swept across. But most of the places we dive, if it's not close to a slack tide, there are places where current's not necessarily a big factor in our decision making. They're more open and aren't a place where current has a tendency to be very high. Doesn't seem like so. I was a little surprised that it was as high as it was where we were. But
well, to be fair, it was kind of a big swing that day between the high and low, although. Yeah, I guess we were there maybe a couple hours after high tide, and it was definitely falling. It fell a couple of feet. I had to drag the little dinghy back down the beach. It's aluminum hull, inflatable, and it wasn't super light, so it was a little bit of a pain to drag it, but managed to get it down on the beach without too much trouble. But it gave me a sense of how much the tide had dropped in the, I don't know, maybe it was about an hour and a half. It wasn't actually that long, so.
Yeah, I think my dive watch said it was like 45 minutes or something that we were underwater, and then another probably 20 minutes of kicking back to the boat.
But. Yeah. So when you're underwater, you've had a chance to, I guess in the last year, it seems like you and Paul were talking that day that you're pushing on around 30 dives, something like that.
Yeah, I've gotten 20 to 30 dives under my belt with him. Which has been, it's been good. It's been fun to experience. I kind of see why people like diving in the winter a little more around here than in the summertime because the visibility is a lot better.
So are you noticing that, you enjoying the winter dives more?
Yeah.
Despite the darker?
Like, I would have to say of the dives I've done so far, probably like October, November has been the months that I've enjoyed diving the most because the water's still like fairly warm. It's close to the temperatures it was in the summertime, but it's cleared up. The plankton aren't blooming as much because the days aren't as warm, and so visibility is better.
Do you notice a difference in water temperature?
Yeah, definitely. When I dove in the summertime, I dove with a lot fewer layers on than I've done in the winter diving.
Well, was it as simple as kind of wearing more layers? Is that enough, or do you just get cold in the winter no matter how many layers?
In my experience, it's just been like your face will get cold because it's not covered, but since I'm wearing a dry suit, I just put on more layers, add a little more weight to balance out the buoyancy I've added because of the layers, and it's fine. Yeah. I haven't had any problems with it.
So you have highlights of, so you've mentioned a couple places. Well, kind of near Cassiana, you described that as, what was it, kind of shell hash you were saying?
Yeah, shell hash.
Bottom. And a little bit of rockiness. No Thoroughfare, I'm guessing, is pretty rocky.
It's a mix
shallow,
of rocks and shell. Is actually the mouth of it was like all shell, which kind of surprised me.
Oh, just outside
yeah, like
the channel?
Outside the narrow part.
Oh, that's kinda, probably where all the stuff gets flushed out and settles, I guess.
And even in the channel a little bit, it was a mix of rock and shells. There was lots of sea anemones in there, though.
Yeah, on the walls, I've seen that at low tide, that they're just covered in sea anemones. So what other sorts of habitats have you explored?
I've explored like hard rock bottoms, cliffs, like the rock cliffs and stuff underwater, and then sand. And Paul and I have done one dive in like mud silt, which was an interesting dive. I personally kind of enjoy diving the sand and the silt substrates more than the hard rocks. Just the thing, the critters I find in the in those type of substrates, I find more interesting, and the ones I'm looking for, I find more interesting, like shrimps and stuff. And yeah, I just enjoy that type of substrate, even though it's kind of hard to see sometimes if you stay in one spot and kick up too much. It becomes very hard to see where you are or where your dive buddy is or anything you were trying to look at before. So it's kind of, you find the critter, you take a quick picture of it, get your quick pictures taken, and then move on before stirring up too much silt.
Yeah, I imagine that especially the sort of silty, muddy bottoms can get cloudy pretty quick.
Yeah.
Well, so what you mentioned, shrimp, are there particular groups? I know Paul does massive, iNaturalist dumps of all the things that, that he photographs. I don't see you posting quite as much stuff as he tends to. Are there things that you're preferring to focus on? Or are you just still getting the hang of the diving part, and so the ability to sort of freely document or observe and document your focus, it feels like it splits your focus too much from diving safely? Or
In the beginning, it was definitely splitting my focus a little more because I was getting more used to and being comfortable underwater. But in the last several dives, I've begun to focus more on things I'm looking at. And the blade shrimp, I don't remember the genus of them, but those are the main ones. And then also just any new shrimp I see. But the blade shrimps are the ones because I feel like I don't see as much representation of them on iNaturalist and stuff as like the bigger shrimps that people catch in shrimp pots and the other shrimps that are closer that you find at low tide on the beaches. And so I go out looking for them, and they're in many different types of habitat, silt being one of them. And so since we've been doing mostly night dives when I've been diving, because that's just when I get off of work and what works for my schedule, shrimp are out a lot more, and so they're a lot easier to see and take pictures of. And blade shrimps are definitely high on the list of.
Are there multiple species of those?
Yeah, there's multiple species. Paul and I actually, Paul found one they pointed out to me when we dove deep inlet back in like October that like had only one or two records on iNaturalist of in the world. And so that was a fun shrimp to photograph and see. I'd have to say Deep Inlet was probably one of my more favorite dives. Just
were you diving in Deep Inlet or at the mouth?
We were diving just right at that narrow bottleneck.
At the mouth?
At the mouth slash slightly into it. If you dive too far in, it gets really deep. There's like, if you look at the charts, there's a spot where it comes up at like the neck of the bay.
So you were at the sill kind of?
Yeah, we were at the sill and dove that. Because I wanted to actually see the bottom and not just swim around and look at the cliffs the whole time. And so we dove that, and I got several new species on there, that shrimp being one of them.
I feel like I remember, well, it's been quite a few years now, when I was teaching at Sheldon Jackson, and they had a camera they could drop into the water that they would go to that sill sometimes, and there were a lot of the feather stars, I guess. I think that's what they're called.
Yeah, there's a lot of feather stars down there. A few different species of nudibranchs as well, which I was glad to get.
Well, it's interesting, some of those, yeah, I don't think Silver Bay has one of those, but some of the smaller, I mean, essentially Redoubt has that, but now that sill is out of the water. And so it's a freshwater lake with a brackish lower levels. And I think there's quite a few bays, or like even where it gets over carved kind of back further, and then it comes up and over. And so you get these deepened basins where the bay itself can be quite deep, carved out by the glaciers, but a bit shallower at the mouth of it. And I guess that's probably, there's current and nutrients and stuff flowing over there. Maybe, I don't know, just speculating that it might make a nice habitat for for things that want to be eating, and most things want to be eating. So how deep is it there?
I think it was like 100 to 120 or something. It wasn't so deep that it was, yeah, like I only dived down to 130, so it wasn't deeper than that.
And you find it, how come, do you just find more stuff on the bottom, or you don't enjoy the vertical experience of looking at cliffs?
Yeah, it's a mix. I'm not quite as adept at controlling my buoyancy, and so it's a little more challenging for me to stay oriented to what I want to take pictures of on the sides, and I also don't necessarily like looking up quite as much. The problem's gotten fixed now, but back when I was diving those times, if I looked up too much or I looked up wrong, the next seal would leak, and so I'd get water into my dry suit. So I basically always wanted to stay flat / pointed down slightly to keep from getting water. And then when my mask leaks a little, looking up will get the water down close to my eyes, whereas if I'm just looking straight down, it'll like pool on the bottom of the mask. And I'll have to flush the mask every so often, but it's just easier to see things for me on the bottom.
Hmm.
I can
so
lay
it's
down.
Been a little while since you've done the vertical.
We typically do a vertical on the way out.
Yeah, just coming back up.
And a lot of those places, like we dove off the causeway or close to the causeway one time, and it was one of those things where, like, down, you get down to 80 or 90 feet, it was mostly ground and everything, but coming back 50 or 60, there was cliffs that we would look at, and but the current out there from the just rushing of the water on the rocks made it hard for me to stay oriented to take the picture of the thing on the wall.
So you have particular highlights? Sounds like you like the more obscure shrimps and other things that you keep an eye out for.
Yeah, fishes, any new fishes, basically, pricklebacks, and like I like the more obscure type, but not super big, bright, colorful ones as much. So some of the smaller, more obscure sculpins or flatfish, things of that nature, I enjoy taking pictures of more.
And have you been noticing, well, I mean, you already mentioned that the shrimp seem to be out more at night. I've been noticing other sort of patterns of behavior or occurrence, you know, where you tend to find things versus not, or what they tend to be doing.
Rockfish seem to be more cooperative at nighttime or in the dark. They don't flush as swim away as much or tuck themselves into holes. And like there's certain like basket stars or feather stars, I should say, I see more in higher current areas and than other places.
Well, I guess that probably makes sense. They got those big long things there, probably are like in the current to catch stuff drifting by. More of a passive than active would be my guess. I don't really know what their feeding ecology is, but given their structure, it seems likely that they're kind of sifting the seas and pulling out the stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the fish, the sculpins, yeah, there's a lot of little sculpins. Do you do much with rockfish? Well, I guess, yeah, so you're taking pictures. It's dark down there, especially at night, but even during the day, it's not super bright. So you got a light to get the pictures, light set up. What do the animals care about the light, or are they curious?
It depends on the animal, it seems like. Shrimp, sometimes they either try to hide or get away from it, or they'll try to come really close to it, which makes it kind of hard because I like to try to get more profile shots, and they'll be tucking themselves up close to the camera housing, where the light's not quite as good and the angle's not quite right. And so it's kind of, so I have to move the camera housing to try to get better pictures of them. And for the most part, it seems like the fishes, some of them don't like it at all. Most of them are tolerant of it, at least for a little bit.
So they're not just immediately swimming away.
Yeah, they don't swim as soon as you shine a light on them most of the time. They'll, like, if you get way too close, they'll do it. And some of them will. I've had a couple fishes I've tried to take pictures of that just, like, as soon as I saw them and was just about getting ready to try to get my camera ready, they were gone. And some of them I can follow and track and go find them again, but that particular one just was gone. I didn't see it again.
Did they ever attack you?
No, I've never had any fish attack me.
Guarding nests or egg nests or anything?
No, I haven't had any issues with that.
I guess I've heard that there are some species that are kind of aggressive defenders of their, the males will guard egg masses, basically, kind of like a nest. And but yeah, I guess that'd be something interesting. If only it were so easy with the birds.
Yeah.
They seem to like to fly away a little. Although on the upside, we can see them from further away. I imagine that your distance of visibility is relatively limited underwater, especially if it's dark.
Yeah, it definitely is not very far. It was interesting diving on Saturday because that was like the first daytime dive I'd had in months, since the summer basically. And I was like, oh, you can actually see something outside the light of the flashlight.
And do you have you gone to the same place more than once?
No, we haven't dove the same spot more than once, with the exception being like if like several of the dives Paul and I have done, we would do one dive and then do a second dive that same trip. And so we typically anchored in one spot. We'll do one dive and go one direction and then do a second dive and do another direction. So we dive the same general area, but typically we haven't repeated our holes.
Yeah, it's kind of one of the questions that I am curious about is just like, well, you know, how much is it the same versus different, you know, on different trips? How much is stuff changing? I imagine there's, you know, you find the hole that fish likes. If it's a long-lived fish, it probably is there every time, kind of thing. And but then there's just the things that are there but you didn't notice, and, you know, go 10 feet that way and suddenly there's something there that you've totally missed the first time. I mean, I experienced that on land and I could see better on land. So but then there's the whole sound out there. You're like, well, all the places, don't know what's anywhere. So hard to decide. Everybody has their sort of, I guess, default tendencies as to whether they like to explore new different places, or, you know, variations on the theme of returning, or a little bit of both. It partly depends on your mobility, I guess. If you're limited to going from the road system, there's not as many places, but it seems like there are a few places people like to dive from along the road system. Although I imagine, I guess you're hauling gear no matter what. That did seem like, seeing all the gear that y'all had to deal with, the tanks don't look light.
No, tanks aren't light. And then you got all the weight to counteract your body weight, which is 30 pounds or so, 30 to 40 pounds typically, and depending on how many layers you have on.
Yeah. Wow. Well, so switching topics here to above the water, what we more often talk about, what were your bird highlights of the last year?
Probably the fact that I got to get out more. So like I got out to cruise off more on my little skiff and got to see shorebirds over there more, even if the weather wasn't always great. It was just nice to get out and see the shorebirds that didn't necessarily see in town in the same kind of numbers or at all for some of them. We were able to make a trip up to Sea Lion Cove in, I want to say, June, and hike across, which was the first time I can remember being over there.
And I guess you were over there, but you were almost one when you I have pictures of you over there, but yes, you wouldn't likely remember that trip.
Yeah, and I'd been out front of Sea Lion Cove before fishing, so I'd seen the beach and everything, but it was the first time actually getting to walk the beach and just see how different the habitat over there was from anything in town. Like there was actually like sand dunes and things of that nature that I've seen down south in places, but like you don't find that type of stuff along the road system. And then I got see a snowy plover, which I've seen in California and along the coast in the lower 48 before, but it's the first time I'd seen it in Alaska, which was a new bird for me here, which I always like getting.
Yeah, well, so stepping back to the cruise off spring was, let's just say, not super inviting for weather-wise for getting out. There was daylight, and so we went out several times after you got off work in the evening. Several times it was lumpy and wet, let's just say, even dropping in at Stargavin, just making that corner around Guide Island to get over to Point Brown. Yeah, Inner Point was just a no-go. It would have been nice to get over there. But checking out Port Krestoff, Point Brown and Port Krestoff, and there were some good numbers of birds there at times. But yeah, it was definitely not a pleasant weather spring. It was basically after the first week of April, which is pretty much when shorebird season doesn't start kind of until mid-April, until like the second week of June, it was this gray and cloudy and awful lot of wind, it seemed like. We did make it over to Low Island, I think, in the spring, and we did make it to Inner Point a couple of times, but mostly it was Port Krestoff, it seems like. But yeah, there was nice numbers of shorebirds over there at Point Brown for a little while and Port Krestoff. And I guess even at Inner Point, and as we got more into the summer and we're continued, it was interesting. Some of those shorebirds were sticking around, and it's one of those things where it's like we saw whimbrels well into June.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's normal or not, because, I mean, who's looking over there at that point? So I think we saw some other sort of shorebirds throughout, you know, the various trips that we were able to make out there during the summer. So that was kind of, that was just interesting to me, because like I say, I don't know what's typical. You know, sometimes was it just the bad spring and stuff's like, we're not going any further north if it's like this. We'll just hang out here and then turn around and go south, you know, non-breeders or whatever at that point. So it would be curious to, or I would be curious to, you know, kind of do that over several years and see, like, is that a normal thing, or are they mostly just, you know, gone? Typically, especially based on what I see in town, would it tend to expect that there is very little in the way of shorebirds through most of June. You know, you have field lingering ones the first week or so of June, but I think we saw them even into July.
Yeah, I don't think there was really a trip where we didn't see at least a couple that weren't like your oyster catchers and the ones that breed here. I think there wasn't necessarily high numbers of them, but there was always like one or two. It felt like,
yeah, and there was some Brant, I think.
Brant, I think, were into June, maybe even July. Like, there was long-staying birds. But.
And July is when I start to expect southbound migrants to show up. So there are definitely some more birds starting to show up, the peeps, the westerns and least sandpipers sorts of things. And so that was interesting to get a little more sense of that. Then Sea Lion Cove, I guess, was in June. So, you know, not any big thing for you, second state record of snowy plover, because Mr. two first state records over there. So, but for me, I think that was the first second state record I have, I think. I don't know. I've had some less than 10 state records before, but I don't think I have seen anything that was fewer than second. Well, certainly not fewer than second. I don't even think I have any other things that were second state records. So that was kind of interesting to me. What was pretty... I'd never seen, well, maybe, I don't think I'd seen a snowy plover before. If I had, I didn't really make note of it. I could have seen it on a trip when I was in California or something in the winter, because they winter down there. But I think the furthest north they sort of semi-regularly occur is southern Vancouver Island. There's, on the outer coast there, there's a big white sand beach area. But I was intrigued by how easily it disappeared when it stopped moving. I mean, there's nothing out there on the beach other than just sand, and then it would stop moving. You're like, where'd it go? If you weren't watching it. So that was kind of intriguing to me. And it didn't seem too skittish, you know, as long as you didn't chase it. If you were willing to be patient and kind of sit with it, it seemed to be fine. I think I even have a picture of you getting pictures of the bird, and, you know, you're both just kind of standing there, sitting there, looking at each other. But if you don't know the bird is there, it's easy to be like, why is Connor just sitting on the sand like that, looking like he's looking at something? But yeah, was there any particular things that stood out to you about the bird other than just getting the new bird for the state?
I mean, yeah, it blended in surprisingly well with the beach, because I didn't see it until I was walking the surf line just to check, just in case there was something small out there that I couldn't see from the top of the beach. I was pretty sure I could see everything. But I didn't see it until it was moving across the surf line in front of me. And yeah, it looked so different from any of the other plovers that we get here, that it was one of those where I was trying to turn semi-palmated plovers into snowy plovers for any one that was slightly pale, be like, oh, maybe. And then when I actually saw one, it was like, no, there was like no way I would be turning a semi-palmated into that.
That was, yeah, maybe a common plover or whatever. Those ones look similar, I guess. But yeah, a snowy plover looked way different than anything I've seen in terms of our normal plovers here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was kind of a, we ended up having a long-ish day, partly because we spent like 2 hours getting pictures of the plover. But yeah, that was the first time I'd been back to Sea Lion Cove. I think maybe I've been there 5 or 6 times overall. It's just, it's a long enough run, especially if you're coming from town, like from the harbors in town and going through the channel, that it's not everybody's cup of tea to make that run, but it wasn't too bad. I think it was a little over an hour in the boat into Cleanin' Bay. And, you know, thanks to the do-gooders who made it so we didn't have to swim for the anchor shoreline, I guess.
Yeah, that was definitely much appreciated.
Yeah, that was, we got there around low tide, I think. Was the tide still falling?
Yeah, I think the tide was still falling because I think I just parked it on the beach.
Yeah.
And
then you brought a shoreline up to, of course, it was calm in there. You brought a shoreline up to the rocks. And
as far as I could get it.
Yeah, I remember saying we should probably go over there because this is probably going to be hard to get to when the tide's up, because it would be far away, kind of, or to head over to the side where the beach isn't quite as wide. And little did I know. So there were some other folks over there that day that went over, like were behind us going over and ahead of us going back. They didn't spend as long over there. And when we got back, it's like, oh, there's the rock underwater where we had our line, but the line was up. Somebody had moved it up into the, tied it around the trees.
Yeah.
So I guess another lesson learned.
Yeah. It's kind of the risk you play when you don't have a boat that you can just anchor out in the middle and then have a little skiff to row to shore and carry up to the tree line.
Yeah, we didn't have to swim for the boat, at least. It was just, we would have had to...
We would have had to wait a while for it to drop.
Or snorkel for the, you know, basically go for a swim to get the shoreline. If we had got the shoreline, it would have been fine probably. But it would have been wet and cold. It was interesting to explore kind of the dunes, the north end of the beach there. There's kind of these, I guess, stabilized dunes and some different species of plants there that I hadn't noticed before. Of course, it's been so long since I'd been there. I have a little better sense of what's around or what stuff is, I guess, and what's familiar than I did the last time I was there. So that for me was enjoyable. And then there was the kayakers, I guess, that had started at Weiss Sulphur, and I guess they were going to get picked up at Chillicothe, but seemed like they'd had some, there'd been some rough weather, I think, in the days before.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember it was just a crossing to get around the corner from Neva to Cleanin' was a little rough just because of the wind coming out of Peril.
Right. Yeah, that's right, because the day before there'd been a kind of a squall line that moved through, and the trail, Sitka Trail Works, was doing some work over there, and they told me about that, just utterly downpouring, and that I think caused some trouble in Juneau when that whole squall line, I think that was around that same time, so a bit of violent weather in the summer, but yeah, it was fun to get over there, and hopefully it won't be another 14 years before I get back again, but I remember you saying, oh, now I know why you kept wanting to come up here.
Yeah.
You didn't seem to get why I thought that was a cool place to go. And then we finally made it up there. And be more to explore. There's definitely more that I would have liked to have had a little more time to explore. But it's kind of like, well, I got to, even with a long day, it goes by quick. So that was a fun trip. So that was the first of a handful of, I guess, new birds for you this year.
Yeah.
What was the next one?
The next one was a Western Kingbird that we saw in the muskegs between Point Brown and Port Krestoff. It was opening week, I think it was, and I decided I was going to have the bright idea of tromping around muskegs instead of hunting for bucks on the beach, thinking that would prove more successful. But, I mean, it did in the sense that I got a new bird out of it. And got a Western Kingbird, but didn't see any deer. But it was nice to see the Western Kingbird. It was one that had been in town a couple times before that I had missed whenever it was here in the past.
I think it was only in town once while you were out of town at the time.
Yeah.
I was here. But I think since you've been birding, there's only been one reported here. There was one. Your uncle actually saw one on the east side of the island, which was not chaseable by any means. But and there might have been one out on St. Lazaria, but I think that there's definitely an eastern kingbird reported out there, but might also have been a western kingbird. So in any case, though, yeah, it was not. It was one I had seen before, but not you. Yeah, that was kind of fun to see, just sort of randomly. I guess that was early August. Also, there was some orchids there that that I had only seen once before on Fred's Creek Trail. They seemed to be not common, but Platanthera ephemerantha was interesting for me to see. And I'm still remain really curious about the otter trailers, like in around Sitka and the road system. I've never seen one, but over there, when we've been wandering around a little bit, I've seen them in a couple of places at least where they look kind of like deer trails, except for they don't move like deer trails. And deer trails, the edges of them tend to be kind of outward, whereas the otter trails, the vegetation kind of hangs over a little bit. And then the otter trails go through any puddle that's around. They're like, oh, puddle. We're going to go through the puddle, not around the puddle. And a deer trail, of course, would go around the puddle. So that was interesting for me to see. And I would like to follow it more intentionally. And we followed it a little bit that day. As it turned out, I didn't quite realize it at the time. I was a little disoriented based on, you know, what I remembered from the map and where we actually were. So it was only after the fact that I realized, oh, that was actually the continuation of that otter trail. And it was going where I thought that it probably went. I just hadn't made that connection at the time. And if I had, I probably would have followed it a little more closely and gotten some more photos of it. But yeah, I'm just intrigued by that, how often they use it and you know, where they're going. So I still would like to get a trail cam set up, maybe in a couple different places along that trail, just to see what they're doing. Maybe leave them up for a few months or a year and see what the otters be doing in that neck of the woods. But yeah, that was just an evening. Yeah, it seemed like that was an evening after work outing there when we still had daylight into the evening.
Yeah, it was definitely during the time when it was light until 8 or 9 o'clock, and I could get off work at 4, 4:30, or 5:30, depending on the day of the week, and drop the boat in and run over for an hour or two, come back.
Yeah, there were some days I felt like we were pushing darkness a little hard.
Yeah. You're pushing it close a little bit, but
yeah, it's kind of the way that it goes sometimes, and better lighting would be helpful. But the so that was the kingbird. So that was two new birds for you. The kingbird, not especially, it's rare, but you know, very rare for here, but not like by state standards. They're every few years at least, it seems like one shows up somewhere.
Yeah, I think there was like two others elsewhere in the state during that same week that showed up. But then the next one don't remember what the next one was actually. I remember the two in November, the Dickcissel and the Harris's Sparrow, but I was pretty sure I had one before then that I'm forgetting about.
Did you get five this year?
I think I did get five this year, yeah.
Yeah, I think I ended up with four because I counted the Sora.
Yeah.
Which wasn't the most aesthetically satisfying of sightings, I'll have to say, but.
Yeah. I remember the third one now, which is a three-toed woodpecker I got up at the back end of Fish Bay when we ran up there, go deer hunting / looking for other stuff.
Go for a walk in the woods.
Go for an armed walk in the woods. Yep.
Yeah. And yeah, that one was an interesting one because there was some stuff up there that, it's a very large valley, big, flat, broad valley. I'd been on the beach there a couple times, but it'd been a lot of years and I never wandered around up there. And that was a nice fall day. We went up there. I'm glad that you didn't shoot a deer.
As am I.
Up at the upper end, but the beaver swamps, not something that I see too often. Avoiding those as much as possible. That's the only coot I saw this fall, as it turned out, was up there, because I didn't end up seeing one on Swan Lake. That's the first time in decades, I think, that we didn't have a coot on Swan Lake here, or at least none reported. And then that three-toed woodpecker, which I guess is a Sitka bird for me, because technically I'd seen one on Jacobi Island, which is technically outside of the boundaries of Sitka. So that added me a Sitka bird, but not a state bird. So
yeah, it was interesting to get to experience the walking around up there in Fish Bay, because that valley is also the habitat up there is just so different from anything that we have really very close to town at all, especially along the road system, that it was fun. It wasn't the first time I had seen beaver swamps, but it was fun to be able to walk around and see the beaver chews on the trees and all that. And three-toed woodpecker was in my mind. It was something I'd always keep an eye out for, but it was especially doing up there just because it was one of those things where, oh, we're away from town, maybe the possibility is a little higher up here or whatnot. But and so it was nice to see. It was interesting to see how the river up there braided through the trees as much as it did, because a lot of the rivers, like Indian River and big rivers along the road system, they're confined to a narrow river channel and not spreading out through the trees in the same way, which was a new experience for me to get to try to navigate that and try to move very fast at all.
Yeah, it's a long run back to town, so we wanted to not be pushing dark too hard. And also, I guess we were concerned about the tide because it would have been falling tide then. So, yeah, it seems like the deer that you could have shot was at the very farthest up the valley that we went, of course. I think we assumed that, looking at the satellite imagery, that it was just big forest, that it'd be easy walking. Did not turn out to be the case. It wasn't terrible, but as you were saying, there are these braided rivers. And to be fair, that system is much, much larger than anything along the road system. So we just don't have that kind of river system, you know, in size of a valley that's along the road system. I kind of suspect there are some other large valley systems that would be similar. That kind of those channels, and they were so deep in the forest, some of them, it's like, fortunately there was places that we could find across the little side channels and whatever that were there, because I wouldn't have wanted to wade them. They would have been waist deep or deeper. And we ended up making pretty decent time, but it would have been a challenge if you'd had a deer on your back.
Yeah, a lot of the crossings were walking on sketchy logs that spanned something that was just a little too wide to jump or feel confident about being able to jump and not falling in the water, which would have been extremely difficult with a deer with the extra weight to do well. And then there's just some channels that you would have had to swim in places to try to get across.
Well, we saw the coot and the three-toed woodpecker, and three-toed woodpeckers seem to prefer more scrubby forest, although that was pretty, it was wet forest, but it was still pretty big trees. I kind of wonder if you went down by Goddard and stuff around there, if they're more common. But yeah, every once in a while they get reported near town, but not very often. And then that was also the trip, I think, we saw the ruddy duck.
Did see a ruddy duck up there. And then I also saw a male Eurasian widgeon, which, like, they're almost annual, but not quite here around town.
I think they probably are annual around town on the road system, not almost every year, yeah, even along the road system. But like, I think we saw them over at Port Krestoff in the spring.
Yeah.
Also. Male Eurasian widgeons. And then, yeah, so that was an interesting trip. I collected a lot of mushrooms on that trip. There's quite a few fruited mushrooms. Also, there was a plant that I didn't recognize. It's not too often that I run into vascular plants that I don't recognize. So that's one I'd like to get back up there for in the summer. I don't know if that'll happen. There's some places I'd like to explore in Fish Bay, but it's a pretty good run from town, even dropping in at Stargaven. So I don't know. And you have that little bit of got to get around through Salisbury, which can be pretty gross in the size of boat you have. So
Salisbury is always the pinch point for me getting back up there, because I've got to have the days off, and then I've also got to have had the weather to make it across that. The back of the bay there, which can get, my experience fishing in that part of the world, it can get pretty gross in the back for the size of boat that I'd be running up there in. So
and I guess we did a little bit of a trip over to Chichikov, Southwest Chichikov there, and on day you were hunting, and ran into beaver activity there. And one of the things that made me curious there was the channels. And I kind of think that the beavers must be excavating the channels And which I guess would make sense. It makes it easier for them to like escape, and they can swim deeper in the water in these channels. But I was surprised they were relatively narrow channels. Yeah, probably like if I got a running jump, although the conditions weren't really great for running, I could probably make it across, but just, you know, but they were probably more than waist deep generally. And I walked along one for quite a while looking for a shallow spot. And the only places I found shallow spots is where they had actually built a bit of a dam. And then I could cross on the dam. So, yeah, it was interesting to see that. I don't, you know, have opportunity to see a lot of beaver activity along the road system, which is mostly where I've explored. So that was another interesting outing that we managed to make it on. And then I guess, yeah, you mentioned already the Harris's sparrow and the Dick Sissel, which showed up in our yard. That was the least adventurous of the bunch, I suppose.
Yeah, it was. You just looked out the window and there they were.
Yeah, one after the other. So that was kind of a fun, that was a fun November experience to get those. And so, yeah, not a bad year for, didn't travel much, but getting five new birds in a year is especially at the number of birds you got, that's a pretty good number. And I guess we did do a little bit of adventuring in the boat that was semi-bird related at times. We went out to the Cape and we
ran out past the Cape, went out to the Cape once or twice, and ran out past it one day. Went out there and joined all the charter guys fishing for salmon.
Well,
off
it was
the
charter and commercial both, because it was that first, like the 3rd of July, I think, the King opener was going. And yeah, it's kind of funny. I may not be the wisest move to go out there, but it was in the boat that you got anyway. It was a flat, calm day, though. It was beautiful out there. Just glassy, little bit of swell, but hardly any. And I guess you said you didn't actually have all that much fuel, which would be a bad place to run out of fuel.
Kind of squashed my dreams of going out further. Had I realized that it was going to be so nice, I would have prepared accordingly and had extra Jerry jugs, and we could have really gone out. I would have probably been inclined to try to run to the shelf, and just because we had the weather for it, and
yeah,
run out and look.
Well, there was, you know, we ran through that cluster of boats, and I wondered what those guys were thinking, seeing us sitting there in a little whaler, you know, zipping along. You know, we got out far enough. We saw some. There wasn't a whole lot of birds out there. We saw some fulmars, but not a lot else. I kind of think there was a boat that we could see further out that I suspect was, well, I think you said it was probably black cod fishing.
Yeah.
Sport black cod fishing. And if it wasn't that much further, it would have been, you know, probably 5-10 minutes to run out there. But of course that you got to do that back also. And then fuel is what it is. So, that one, if they were black cod fishing, we probably would have been able to see albatross out there, but
yeah,
that would have been fun. But yeah, it was a little weird. There was a couple evenings when we went out, you know, just kind of to the Cape area when the weather was okay. But boy, when you start to get out there in a little boat and you're just like, there's nobody else out there, it starts to feel like you're hanging out there at the edge of the world. And it felt a little more comfortable when there's other boats. You're like, well, if something goes wrong, at least there's boats we can radio and get some help from.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a different world when you start to get out that far.
Yeah, it definitely felt a lot more comfortable when it was actually not windy, which is what it was doing the other days out there. We tried to go out there. It was like a northwest wind or something, and it was, you look past the Cape and you can see the significantly bigger white caps, and it's like, no, we're not doing that today.
Yeah, we had our fill of white caps in my experience. Your boat is a low rider, let's call it that. At the best of circumstances, it's a low rider. And it's not in the best of its circumstances right now. And there was definitely some days in the spring where it was like, these waves feel a little uncomfortable, you know, in a big sturdy boat, they wouldn't have been any big deal. But in a little boat where, you know, you practically feel like you're sitting in the water already, it made things a little adventurous. We definitely took the long way around a couple of times. I suppose well, what was the word that you used? The sportiest of the trips?
Yeah, the sportiest of the trips.
was that day you got off work early and you're like, well, I want to go hunting. And I was like, isn't the wind supposed to come up? Oh, it says it's, yeah, some gusts, but not supposed to be that bad.
Gusts of 20 or something.
Yeah, but the base wind was supposed to be 6 or something like that. So
like, supposed to be reasonable, like base wind to 10 and a gust of 20 or something. And
so we headed out. And yeah, that one got a little sporty, I guess is the word.
It got a little sporty, all right, coming back from Port Krestoff. Had to run the long way around because I was not doing... Even the long way around through Krestoff Sound was interesting.
Yeah, Krestoff Sound had a little bit of a side wind, but most of it seemed fine. And then when we were running into Whitecaps halfway up Olga Strait, it's like, this doesn't bode well.
Yeah, and it definitely didn't bode well. It was one of those trips where you cross your fingers, nothing happens to the engine between where you are in the harbor.
Yeah, as I recall, it ended up being more like blowing 20 to 25 with gusts to 35 or something like that.
Gusts felt like more like 40 or 50 is what it felt
like. And that was at the airport. That was the conditions reported at the airport. Yeah, I remember kind of doing that crossing there, coming across from the lower end of Olga over to Dog Point, which was the worst section. Then it was much less bad once we got over there, but it was kind of like you were going a certain speed. I think you told me later all the waves were the same height, which made it okay, basically. If they'd been different heights, it would have been a problem. So we didn't, I don't think you really slowed down very much. You might have been throttling up and down a little bit, but overall you kept it on step and the, you know, so we were going probably, 15 to 20 miles an hour, then wind was probably blowing in our face at least that, if not stronger, plus those gusts. And then when we hit the spray, mostly it went over our heads because it was just going by so fast. And every once in a while, I just got smacked in the face with it, though. It was like, it was a little whippy.
It stung a little, yeah. And there's definitely a few of those, especially just before we got back to the ramp at Stargavin, just because the wind seemed to be funneling out of that valley a lot that, most of the time it'd go over your head, but a couple times that it didn't, it would sting.
Yeah, it's the full body experience of full sensory experience, I guess, of being on the water. Yeah, that one was, it was just one of those things where you realize that it was fine as long as it was fine. And then if anything had gone wrong, it would have gotten really bad in a hurry. And you just kind of, those margins start to get a little smaller or a lot smaller at times. But it's not a, It makes me think every once in a while. I much prefer those days. So, when we went to Fish Bay, both the times we went to Fish Bay, it was glassy calm all the way and no problem whatsoever. The day, I guess it was a little lumpy going around the corner to get to Kalinin Bay, but not too bad. It seemed like off Sinitz in there. There was some waves and just the way that it was, the wind was blowing out of the narrows up to the northeast.
Yeah, it was just mostly, those were just the angle that they were hitting us on. Yeah. More broadside was the reason I was really worried about them at all.
But I kind of, in telling people about it, I would joke a little bit. Well, it's adventures of, boating with a young captain, figuring out the things. It seemed like, I don't know that it was half the time, but it seemed like there was some lesson that was learned probably approaching half the time we went out.
Yeah.
Not all of them, or none of them did I feel legit scared in. I think only one I got adrenalated on, but even that sort of sporty experience, like it would have got adrenalated really fast if anything had happened, but since it didn't, it was just like, I think you were a little more tense than I was because you were trying to manage the boat and I was just along for the ride.
On that one, I definitely, like, of all the times I've had to do crossings to get back to town, that was the only one where I actually contemplated stopping and hunkering down. And it was mostly between the mouth of Olga and Dog Point during that bad stretch. And the only reason I didn't was because I knew it wasn't going to get supposed to get better for the next 4 or 5 days. I knew that the wind was just supposed to pick up and it was supposed to be, instead of gusting 35, it's supposed to be gusting 55. And it was like, it's not like, if we stop now, it's not going to get any better later.
And by that time, the only place to stop would have been to get across of it.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't as bad anyway.
Yeah, so. I tucked in close to the shore on the other side, and you had to deal with the reflection a little, but it was a far sight better than it was in the middle.
Yeah, it's an interesting experience. The tides and seeing how things are different on the tides and how fast, that fall trip, that trip, and we went to Inner Point, and I remember going to Inner Point, and when we were coming in, like, there was waves that seemed like wind waves, but it wasn't windy. It was just like the air seemed calm. And I think even at the time I said, I wonder if it's windy down that way, like kind of to the south, which is where it seemed like it was coming from. And sure enough, when we had walked around on the beach, I think maybe only been there about 20 minutes, and then the wind picked up And you're like, we need to get going because it's going to be a problem. And it was a little lumpy getting out, hard to get on step a little bit. But once you got on step, it was fine. But it was an interesting thing. And you commented, you know, because you considered going up in the forest. If we'd gotten there a little earlier and it had been calm, it would have been easy to go up into the woods and had been up there and then notice the wind up there and come back. And had it been too rough to even get out, perhaps, at that point. So, yeah, I guess that's one of those things, like, you know, your grandpa has a story of getting stuck overnight, going to Nakwasina when the weather never came in. And he's like, oh, the forecast kept calling for bad weather and it never came. So they decided to go and then it came and it was okay when they were in there, but they couldn't get back out. Probably that same area where we ran into the rough weather. It was just like too much. So they spent the night on the beach there and were able to get back out the next day. But yeah, it makes you think, yeah, sometimes those things can go from just fine to not at all fine pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's definitely something I have to keep in mind. And I've gotten a little more conservative, especially sitting back and thinking about those days in the last several weeks. It's been like, you know, I didn't necessarily quite appreciate how risky they were at the time, like thinking back on them. And I think part of it was just that it's like, when you're in that situation, it's you can freak out about it and not get anywhere, or you just like buckle down and just get through it and figure out how to not end up getting in trouble.
Yeah.
And cross your fingers and cross your toes and just push through it. And when you don't have an option to stop, and that's probably what I was, some of those situations was definitely where I was at, where it was like, yeah, I don't have time to worry about this now. I've just got to get back to shelter at the dock. I'll be happy once I get back to the dock.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the don't panic mode of dealing with things. And of course, you were fishing, you spent time in much rougher water in a much more capable boat. So, you know, calibrating for the boat you're in is probably one of those things that takes a little bit of experience as well. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting for me. I don't have a lot of experience, out there running around with other people in their boats and mostly pretty calm conditions. And to be fair, it wasn't, you know, none of the stuff we were in was particularly terrible by, you know, if you have a moderately sized boat. But when you're in a little 13-foot whaler, you know, it doesn't take a lot of waves and wind to start to get a little bit sketchy, and stuff can come in over the sides and then you're feeling swamped and all of that. So, yeah. They're definitely questions that are worth asking and reflections to be like, okay, you know, what is the risk here? And it's that, yeah, a lot of times you'll be fine, even if it's a little bit pushing it. It's just like, you keep rolling the dice though. And one of these times, you know, there'll be a stick in the water, just the wrong place, and you can't see it in the waves or, you know, all of that. And those are the sorts of things that kind of come to mind after the fact. You're like, well, I'm glad that didn't happen. And I hope to avoid that sort of sportiness in the future.
Yeah, I definitely will be happy not to need to go through those sorts of experiences again. I mean, I had my fair share of fun in them.
Yeah.
But it was definitely, like, as the year progressed and we got into, like, November and December going out, it was like, I was just like, if there was really any lumps on the water, because that whaler hits hard, it was like, I want to go out on, like nice flat glass days. Like, where I don't have to think about running the throttle. I can just set the throttle and go. Just make sure I don't hit any logs or rope or anything. And just, like, one of those nice, sunny, flat, calm days that we almost never get here.
Yeah, in the winter. Well, you won't get any arguments from me. That's definitely nicer weather. And it's nicer weather for seeing the birds in, too. So,
yeah.
Well, we are at our time here. Any last words you want to mention here?
No.
Well, thanks for coming in. And yeah, thank you for listening this week on the Sitka Nature Show. You've been listening to a conversation with me and my son, Connor, talking about some of our adventures over the past year. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can hop on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a message there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.